You and your dog are a team. Fuel is best in the field and in life with Purina Pro Plan Sport. Made for hardworking dogs of all ages, every sport formula starts with real meat as the number one ingredient and is specifically formulated to support strength and stamina. Try it today and see why Pro Plan is the official dog food of Ducks Unlimited. Learn more at ProPlanSport.com.
Welcome to the Ducks Unlimited podcast, the only podcast about all things waterfowl. From hunting insights to science-based discussions about ducks, geese, and issues affecting waterfowl and wetlands conservation in North America, we bring the resource to you. The DU Podcast with your hosts, Chris Jennings and Dr. Mike Brazier.
On this episode, we're going to be joined again by our special guest from California, Mike Kotsadze, with USGS Western Ecological Research Center. We're going to continue our conversation on radio telemetry and its application to understanding waterfowl. Mike has been involved in telemetry research for a number of years, and Mike has graciously agreed to join us again on this episode. And so here in studio, I have my co-host, Chris Jennings, and then on the phone joining us from California is Mike Kotsadze. Mike, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Mike, and good to talk to both you and Chris.
We left off the last episode having basically covered everything from when we started using telemetry to study waterfowl, talking about the sensors incorporated in these transmitters, what hunters should do if they recover those transmitters, so that and we could have continued on with that conversation for another half hour. But we had to leave out some aspects so we can move on to another topic. And we wanted to ask you, because we know you've been involved in a lot of this research, we wanted to get you to share some insights with our listeners so they can really see the type of questions that can be answered and how they're answered, just to understand a little bit more of the details behind the research that goes into this. So very briefly, maybe to start off, from a big picture view, what are the most common research questions that we've used telemetry to answer, both from a breeding season as well as non-breeding season?
Yeah, so, I mean, obviously telemetry can be a great tool to answer a lot of different questions. The big three are movement. So that includes like local movements. You can see where birds are going to and from, migratory movements included in that movement section. So movements, and then survival. So we have an individual that's radio marked, so we know what's going on with that individual during the time period that we're able to track it. And so we call that kind of a known fate, so we can understand what's affecting that bird's survival. And then the other is habitat use. So those are the three big topic areas of telemetry really allow for a lot of insight.
You mentioned on the previous episode that the state of California and maybe some other partners began investing a fair amount of resources here recently in using radio telemetry to answer some questions of interest out there in your region. Introduce us to that, to what it is that you're doing. What's wrapped up in all of that that thought and the type of questions you're answering?
Yeah, it's telemetry is a tool that allows us to learn so much more about the resource that we're interested in. And so out here in California, you know, the Pacific Flyway, the Central Valley of California is really the heart of the wintering area for the Pacific Flyway. And we, you know, millions of birds spend their winter here. And we really have a great, it's been a pleasure to work with all of our partners. And we've got, you know, from Ducks Unlimited, California Waterfowl, the California Department of Fish and Wildlife, California Department of Water Resources, and down to the local level, and Fish and Wildlife Service. You know, everybody's working together to make sure that we're providing that wintering habitat primarily for waterfowl in the Central Valley, and then as well as the breeding habitat in the summertime. California has a significant amount of that. And it's just been great to work with such a great collaborative team out here to try and answer these questions. And telemetry is allowing us to learn even more. And so specifically, the work we're doing right now is like hitting on all of those topics with all these partners. And we're utilizing this advancement in technology to get at those questions and be more efficient with the limited conservation dollars that are out there.
Preparing for this podcast, we exchanged a few emails, and you shared with us some articles that had resulted from the research, one of which dealt with some really fine scale habitat use. We'll get into that in a minute, but you shared a publication with me that I had not seen yet. It was maybe from, I don't know if it's earlier this year or what, but it spoke about how you use this the new GPS GSM, this high spatial resolution location data to estimate flight speed of different waterfowl species. So that's a topic that I'm sure is going to be of interest. We always have a piece in the magazine about, you know, some sort of quiz about how fast waterfowl fly. But you've actually, for the first time in many, many years, put some additional data to that question. So tell us a little about that.
Yeah, well, the really great thing about these new transmitters, you get locations much more frequently. So you can get locations, you know, every 15 or 30, every 30 minutes, even faster than that, depending on the battery level of the transmitter. So it allows us to monitor how fast a bird's moving, for instance, from point A to point B. And, a lot of the literature, it's kind of interesting. We just thought, well, a lot of the literature shows the flight speed, and a lot of it's recorded from just guys out in their pickup trucks driving alongside birds that are flying and writing down how fast, you know, they were going and how, you know, whether the birds were keeping up or not. And it's coming back from, like, even, you know, back to the 40s and 50s. And so this new technology, we thought, well, this is really great because we can actually, you know, with a lot more certainty, determine, you know, how fast these birds are moving. And we can look at when they're migrating versus when they're making local movements, say within, you know, within the valley here, or, you know, on their trip to for a pintail, maybe up to the prairies. And we can compare those flight speeds as well.
Yeah, that's funny you brought up that. I was reading the white paper on this, and it has the observational, you know, data that's provided, and it has reviewed in Cook 1933. And I just kind of looked at Mike, and I was like, I wonder how they were actually doing that. Like, was he just, you know, standing there using two points and kind of doing the math on it, or like you said, maybe, you know, in a truck, it sounds like, or, you know, who knows? But I'm sure the new technology has really solidified the ability to get that correct speed for sure.
Yeah, and it gives us a lot more confidence in those estimates, you know, and we can, you know, we monitor on several different individuals. And, you know, you can have a fairly robust data set now with these new transmitters and be pretty confident that, yeah, they really are flying at this speed. And, you know, they're upwards of 80 kilometers an hour for some of the bigger ducks. And it's really interesting. And then and then that data can be used to kind of populate some of these energetic models that folks are using, because, you know, flight is very energetically costly. And so knowing how fast and how far individuals are flying, we can get an estimate of how many calories they're burning and, you know, going between feeding and roosting areas and what it's going to take to keep them, healthy and in good shape for the breeding season.
We've talked in previous episodes about how much of the research that is conducted by our waterfowl partners across North America invariably, in nearly every case, has some applied aspect to it. It's relevant to conservation and management of the waterfowl resource, and you address that in the comment that you just provided, Mike, about, well, you know, why do we need to know the flight speed of waterfowl anyway? It's a neat little trivia question, but as you've just described, it has real application too in these bioenergetic models. We haven't introduced those formally on an episode yet, but they are the foundation for the habitat conservation objectives that are put in place by joint ventures, regional joint venture partnerships. We had Dale Humberg on to talk about that, about what those joint ventures are. And so they use all these science-based models to figure out how much habitat they need to be providing. And, you know, these energetic models are really an important piece of that. And how much birds are flying, how fast they're flying, as you've described, all of that matters. Now, one thing I will pause here and ask you to do is translate What was it you said? 85 kilometers per hour or 80 kilometers per hour? Translate that to miles per hour for me, please.
So we're probably looking. I don't have it right in front of me right now, but I'd say, you know, mallards are, I think, what we were looking at, mallards and pinto were flying fairly fast and right around that 60 mile an hour mark.
How many species did you were you able to estimate flight speeds for?
I'm trying to think back. I think we threw one cinnamon teal in there because we were just starting our data on cinnamon teal, and we just had gotten one estimate for cinnamon teal. But we had cinnamon teal and mallard and gadwall and widgeon. So, and I think we did have some northern shoveler in there too. Now here.
Yeah. Do you remember how those speeds fell out among species? I looked at that paper last week, but I can't recall.
The bigger ducks are faster, and the smaller ducks are a little bit slower. I think that's the general gradient. You can correct me if I'm wrong. I don't have it sitting in front of me, but that's the trend.
It surprisingly looked like the shoveler moved pretty quick. That's interesting.
Yes.
And those were – you were able to get flight speeds over for migratory events as well as shorter distance movements. Is that correct?
Yeah, and basically, it's a little harder to get those shorter distance movements because if you're only getting a location every say 30 minutes, if they finish their movement, let's say they fly for 28 of those minutes and maybe land a little early, you're going to estimate a little bit slower flight speed. Whereas the migratory flights, they'll fly for hours and hours at a time, so. You have much less chance of getting any on the ground time with those flights.
You weren't able to then estimate flight speed as green winged teal are approaching and buzzing your decoys versus mallards when they're coming in.
No, but I'm not going to put that past us. I think that's definitely going to be something that we'll look at going forward. We just marked green winged teal, which I think are the first green wings that have been marked with GPS GSM transmitters. We marked some this past September, and they're doing really well, and we're getting a lot of data from those. So I'll be looking forward to reporting some flight speeds for greenwings soon, too.
You've mentioned it a few times, and I just want to pause right here just to ensure folks know what we're talking about. When you say GPS, GSM, the GPS is the global positioning system. You get that level of precision around the location. And the GSM, I don't know what GSM stands for, but it's basically that cellular tower network. These things record GPS level locations, accuracy of the locations, and they communicate that information back to you through the cell towers. I know we've covered that in detail on the previous episode, but in case anyone's listening to this for the first time, so I just want to make sure we're clear on that. Anything else exciting or noteworthy from that study on the flight speed?
I think we're really excited to now incorporate that in with the joint venture, and that's using those estimates and some of the other estimates for some of the movement stuff that we're finding, working closely with the joint venture, as you mentioned. Mark Petrie out here from Ducks Unlimited has just done a phenomenal job with some of the habitat mapping and predictions for how much habitat and energy is needed to support the waterfowl populations, and he's worked closely with our Central Valley Joint Venture to do that. And so we're looking forward to working with Mark on that and really incorporating that in, and hopefully be able to apply the information that we've learned.
Hey, Mike, I've got one quick question. Just kind of thumbing through the study, what was the significance of the? And you may have said this. But what is the significance of the migratory flight versus the non-migratory flight as far as the data set? What are you using the info for the non-migratory flight speed?
Yeah, so really trying to get, the non-migratory flights would be these daily flights that are, occurring in the wintertime down here in California, at least. That was the focus of our data set. And so you're getting an idea, how fast they're flying and the distances flown from, feeding to roosting sites. And so that it's more of it's that localized daily kind of a flight speed, as opposed to these, 1 week or 2 week migratory periods where they're migrating, say, from California to Alberta to nest.
But that information is useful in those bioenergetic models, the same as the migration.
Yeah, kind of that local distribution information that would be.
Yeah, I'd almost say it's more. It's. I mean, to me, it's almost more interesting, is because we're looking at how much energy is on the landscape in the Central Valley. It's like, you know, we always use the analogy of setting the table. You know, how much food energy is out there in either rice and wetland plant, you know, in the marshes. And is there enough to sustain the number of birds for the, you know, given the activities that they're doing? And so this is shedding light on those activities, those flights and those movements on a daily basis. So really helping inform that kind of that long-term winter, you know, management of waterfowl in the Central Valley.
You and your dog are a team. Fuel is best in the field and in life with Purina Pro Plan Sport. Made for hardworking dogs of all ages, every sport formula starts with real meat as the number one ingredient and is specifically formulated to support strength and stamina. Try it today and see why ProPlan is the official dog food of Ducks Unlimited. Learn more at ProPlanSport.com.
One other question. I'm just curious. You're probably seeing some pretty fascinating migratory flight times, too. What are some of the just one numbers that kind of jump out at you that you guys looked at and you're like, holy moly, this bird flew from here to here in this amount of time?
Yeah, I mean, they'll average 75 kilometers an hour over a 13, 14, 15 hour period, no problem. And it's just, you know, that expenditure of energy, you know, is just, it's pretty amazing. And they're out, you know, flying, you know, over mountain ranges and over oceans you know, and getting from point A to point B in an amazingly short amount of time.
Yeah, that's pretty impressive.
It really is incredible to think about how much more we're able to understand or just observe with respect to some of the, you might even say, weird things that waterfowl do when they're flying around during winter. Mike, I don't know if you've seen any of these type of shocking movements, but talk to partners and researchers that are doing some of this work along the Gulf Coast or in the Mississippi Alluvial Valley, whether it be with geese or mallards, pintails, whatever the case may be, but they'll tell stories of some of these birds just flying, and a lot of it has to do, I shouldn't say a lot of it, but occasionally the story involves the start of the hunting season. The birds will be relatively sedentary. They'll just be kind of moving around. And then the hunting season opens, and then these birds just start making these erratic movements or else these long-distance movements, sometimes traversing out across the Gulf of Mexico, like they're trying to fly to the Yucatan. Then they turn around and come back, or they go to Texas and then Alabama. Just some crazy movements that we never before would have been able to document without the advent of you know, at least satellite-based telemetry. Now we're able to do it on a much finer spatial and temporal scale with these new types of units. But do you guys, have y'all seen any of those crazy, I call them crazy, unexpected movements out among your birds?
Yeah, we do see a lot of that, and I don't want to get into too much detail because we're working it up right now, but we have one study where we basically looked at about 25 birds before the opening day, a couple weeks before opening day of the hunting season here, and we got, you know, two-minute location data for a 24-hour period on those. And then on opening morning, we turned them back on basically around midnight to get that two-minute data again, and then compare it 2 weeks into the season. So we have three data points on several birds, mostly pintail, and how they react and to that disturbance of the hunting season. It's just and what we're seeing, you know, so there's some, you know, really interesting movements and that you would never see if you just had one or two locations a day, which was, you know, the old way of gathering telemetry data. You'd get, you know, one or two shots a day. And now we're seeing, yeah, some really interesting movements. And then what I think, you know, and I don't want to get out, you know, ahead of my ski tips here, but I think what we see is the birds make a very quick adjustment, and it doesn't take long before they get it figured out. Like, you know, in some instances, it's just a matter of hours where they figure it out. And, you know, the ones that don't figure it out may end up, you know, on the barbecue. But most of them do. I mean, we had, of all those birds, I think we had one bird of the ones that we were able to monitor at that level. Just one of our birds was harvested.
Are you seeing, and maybe you can't share this, but are you seeing birds do any kind of movement from the Central Valley of California into the Intermountain West, let's say midwinter, or do they go from the Central Valley down to Mexico midwinter? Or is that part of the research that you're working up now?
It is, and you know, we're not seeing. I could certainly share that. We're not seeing a lot of those types of movements. You know, we have a cinnamon teal marked across the West right now. We've marked them in 7 Western states, and you know, the cinnamon teal that we mark in California tend to stay in California. We've had a few move down into Mexico. We had our first one actually move into Mexico from California, whereas most of the other states that we marked the cinnamon teal had representative teal move down into Mexico over the winter. So the birds we mark in California, I think, you know, they tend to like it here. They tend to stay pretty local during the winter months. And then, obviously with the pintail and the widgeon and the shoveler, they're all migrating north to breed. But yeah, I know we do see some movements out. It's not quite as much as I had expected. I mean, I could share with you, you know, we marked some pintail. So we marked a pintail, a female pintail here in the wintertime. You know, when we say winter, you know, like we marked her in September. She spent the winter here, then went up to Alberta, Saskatchewan to breed. And then the next winter, she spent it down on the Gulf Coast. You know, and she was down pretty much as far south on the Gulf South tip of Louisiana down there as she could go. And then she, the next summer, breeding up in the Canadian prairies again, and then decided to winter in California. So she's hopping back and forth between flyways, you know, between winters and you know, breeding seasons, and just, you know, didn't really expect to see the banding data didn't indicate that we'd see much of that. And that's been kind of a, you know, an eye-opening thing to look at.
Yeah, that's really cool. And I was gonna ask you that question, if you had some of your ducks that were jumping flyways. We had one a couple years ago that was reported, actually someone in our Sacramento office there, like brother-in-law or something, had harvested a banded bird in the Central Valley, but it was from Japan. So kind of a cool story there. That thing had done some traveling for sure. But I was just, you know, going to ask if you have some of your pintails or any species kind of hopping flyways and going some odd places that you wouldn't expect, because I'm sure you see that. It sounds like you do.
Yeah, no, we absolutely do. And these transmitters have given us the ability to see it probably even more than, you know, ever before. We definitely have a strong connection to, you know, to Russia, a lot with some of the geese that we've marked. Obviously going to Wrangell Island, Russia is a common spot for the snow geese here in California. We had one of our hen pintail look like she nested in Siberia this last breeding season. So we have these jumps between flyways, between continents, and, you know, a definite connection, on some of these coastal areas with, you know, getting over. We haven't seen any in Japan, but Russia certainly is a common, spot for some of the pintail and snow geese. Some of the Ross geese that we marked here in the Central Valley, they, you know, they go up into their breeding areas in the Arctic, and then down to and then spend the next winter have been down more in the Central Flyway in you know, Colorado and through the Central Flyway states. So we see switching of flyways for those geese is pretty common as well.
Mike, are y'all marking mostly females, or is there a mix of males in there with your sample?
You know, we tend to, because we, you know, the sample size is limited and we try and stay consistent. So we end up tending to go towards females because we always want to know where they're nesting, and females tend to, you know, adult females tend to be, you know, usually the main driver in populations, waterfowl populations, in terms of population size. So we tend to, have a higher proportion of females marked. And then also for, like, here for, in California, we're also working on our local nesters, And so for those, we're catching them on nests. So obviously it's all female. So the mallard and mallard and gadwall populations that we mark are primarily females. We do mark some drake mallards. We have not marked any drake gadwall yet. They're just hard to catch not on nest, obviously.
Yeah, gadwall are a species that has stymied researchers in the southeastern U.S. for quite a while in that regard. They're difficult to catch, difficult to study with telemetry. So I hope y'all figure that out. Another question I had for you is whether any of the birds you captured and marked during the winter ended up nesting in California. You talked about the birds that you captured and marked on the nest as local nesters. Did any other birds stick around that you captured in winter?
That's a good question. I'm trying to think. I think primarily it's sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy, because for the most part, when we're marking, when we say winter, our winter capture is just prior to the hunting season. So it's really August, September. And we're marking the birds as, widgeon, American widgeon and pintail and shoveler as they arrive. And, I think for the most part, none of those have stayed to breed in California. We've had a few of the male pintail hang out and stay over the course of the breeding season and not, maybe travel as far north as, the Klamath Basin, and not all the way up to the prairies. But for the most part, the females that we marked in the fall, the non-mallard and non-gadwall, they tend to nest in the other regions and migrate.
Mike, I haven't even touched on this other study that y'all recently completed, it's a data analysis and publication y'all produced the data came from the telemetry that you're describing, this high spatial resolution, high temporal resolution data. You're able to understand these real fine scale movements of waterfowl, fine scale habitat use, and I know that research was pretty interesting. You found some things that were a bit unexpected. So maybe in just a couple of minutes, what were the take homes from that? Traditionally we've studied waterfowl and these habitat use questions, and we thought they moved over large areas, but from my reading of that study, y'all found something a little bit different, didn't you?
Yeah, we did. We expected to see some pretty good, pretty large scale movements. Obviously, the ducks have the ability to fly great distances relatively quickly, as we show with the flight speed paper. But what we found was, for the most part, their daily movements were quite small, less than. Pintail, of the birds we looked at, pintail, mallard, and gadwall, the pintail moved the most, and mallard and gadwall less than that, but still not very much. I mean, less than on an average 24-hour day, if you added up a location, a distance moved between every 30 minutes, it was less than 12 kilometers, I think, for pintail on average. Or right around 12 kilometers and then significantly less than that for mallard and gadwall. And so, we just didn't see the amount of movement, that we thought we would see. And based on some of our other previous VHF telemetry work, we thought we'd see a little bit greater movement. And I think there's a couple quick explanations for that. One is that, all the work from all the partners doing some really good habitat work and creating habitat and spreading it out around the Central Valley. We're providing a pretty decent habitat base. They're not having to move as far as you might expect to get the resources that they need. The conditions here in California are pretty nice. It's, a Mediterranean climate. So, there's not a lot of weather events that are causing the birds that force them to move.
That's the whole intersection between waterfowl movements and weather is an entirely different topic. We had Matt Kaminsky on, and he was giving me on a previous episode, and he was kind of giving me the lowdown on what he looks for in terms of weather patterns that make waterfowl move. And so maybe we'll get you back on at some other point to discuss some of the other findings coming out of your research, as well to delve a little bit in more depth on the whole weather how weather influences those movements. I'd love to hear more about that as informed by some of your telemetry. So before we conclude, I want to emphasize again the point that we made at the end of the previous episode, that if a hunter harvests one of these birds, has a telemetry in it or attached to it, they're not going to get in trouble. We encourage them, we implore them, to report that bird, report it to the bird banding lab, because it's going to have one of the other standard aluminum leg bands, but then also to report it to whomever the researcher is that's doing this, the research using that transmitter, should it have one. And then the information, that contact information, is usually going to be on a separate leg band, or it's going to be on the transmitter itself. And Mike, as you were describing on that previous episode, usually the researchers will go out of their way to provide detailed information on what that bird did, provide a dummy transmitter, but most importantly, the hunter's not in trouble. The hunter is to be thanked for returning that, reporting that, and like we do with bands, we urge all hunters that encounter these birds to return the device, call it in.
Yeah, I appreciate that plug. That's great. Yeah, absolutely. Definitely was second all everything you just said.
Thanks, Mike, for joining us.
It's been my pleasure. I thank you guys for getting the word out on all the work we're doing, and I really appreciate it.
Special thanks to our guest on this episode, Mike Casazza, research wildlife biologist with USGS out in California. I also thank my co-host Chris Jennings for joining us on this episode, and as always, Clay Baird, our producer, who does a great job getting these out to you, our listeners. And thank you, our listeners, for joining us. Thanks for sharing your time with us. Let us know how we're doing. Let us know what you think of the podcast. You can submit comments at dupodcast@ducks.org, or submit comments wherever you get your podcast. Let us know how we're doing. And thanks, as always, for your commitment to wetlands and waterfowl conservation.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the DU Podcast. Be sure to rate, review, and subscribe to the show, and visit www.ducks.org/DU Podcast for resources based on today's topics, as well as access to more episodes. Opinions expressed by guests do not necessarily reflect those of Ducks Unlimited. Until next time, stay tuned to the ducks. You and your dog are a team. Fuel is best in the field and in life with Purina Pro Plan Sport. Made for hardworking dogs of all ages, every sport formula starts with real meat as the number one ingredient and is specifically formulated to support strength and stamina. Try it today and see why Pro Plan is the official dog food of Ducks Unlimited. Learn more at ProPlanSport.com.